world is just one big catwalk, your own personal runway? Here's our look at some of the hottest new species discovered this past year, as well as the animals who made a comeback and the ones no longer with us. New this year is Ocerax mucoflorus, or the bone-eating snot flower. It's an elegant new species of marine worm discovered off the Swedish coast. It lives off whalebone on the ocean floor. Its root system extends into the bone and plumes out like a flower, with lovely mucus-covered petals. From the forests of Tanzania comes Africa's first new species of monkey in more than 20 years, the Highland mangabe, Lophosibus kipungi. It models cheek whiskers, a cream belly and tail, and long crest of hair on its head, as well as an unusual call its discoverers call a honk bark. Though just emerging on the scene, the Highland mangabe is already critically endangered because of illegal logging. And of course, the nostalgic star of the year was rediscovered in the big woods of Arkansas, the ivory-billed woodpecker, Campephalus principalis. The largest woodpecker in North America re-emerged this spring, 60 years after its last confirmed sighting in the United States. But as fads move in and out and trends supersede each other, for some species to succeed, others must fail. According to BirdLife International, one species was officially declared extinct in 2005. The thick-billed ground dove disappeared after much of its habitat in the Solomon Islands was opened to logging. The introduction of rats, dogs, and cats didn't help much either. Alas, extinction is a natural feature of evolution. But the World Wildlife Foundation estimates that current extinction rates are between 100 and 1,000 times the background extinction rate, at which species would naturally go extinct without human intervention. That's this week's note on emerging science. I'm Emily Torgrimson.
And you're listening to Living on Earth.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. The Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Annenberg Fund, for excellence in communications and education, and the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
It's Living on Earth. I'm Steve Kerwood. Some people exult in their work while others struggle just to show up each day. Some prosper in their careers while others end up broken-spirited and bankrupt. Harry Goldstein has this reporter's notebook about a man who loved his work and invented a way to make a better car, but took a wrong turn on the road to success.
It's cold.
You've never heard of Corliss Orville Barrant. I hadn't either, until someone slapped a 10-page fax down on my desk that Barrant, or Cobb as he calls himself, sent me about the flood of hybrid electric cars onto the world market. Cobb claimed to have invented and patented a way of using a sensor inside a cylinder of a car engine to optimize how air and fuel mix during combustion. He claims almost all hybrid cars on the market are using a version of his invention. But Cobb didn't get rich off his patent. Instead, he lost his house, his wife, and his mind. Somehow, through years of homelessness, Cobb and some well-meaning friends have preserved a prototype of his invention. It sits in the trunk of a sky blue 1965 Corvair in an auto shop in the Minneapolis suburb of Ham Lake. My friend John Zern drove me out there to meet Cobb and see the Corvair. The day was blindingly bright and frigid.
Fast traffic. Now look at the weather forecast with Mike Lynch.
We are chilling and thrilling. We've got all kinds of cold air all around CCO land. The Arctic siege continues. The macho cold air directly, live and direct from the North Pole.
I explained to John that Cobb's story serves as a warning to all inventors who exchange rights to their patents in return for venture capital to bring those inventions to market. Cobb thought he was on his way to Easy Street when in 2002 he discovered that Honda's intelligent VTEC engine used technology similar to that described in his U.S. patent number 4961406. issued on October 9, 1990. This patent covers a, quote, method and device for optimizing the air-fuel mixture burn rate of internal combustion engines.
So, you know, Cobb's, did you get Cobb's name?
Corliss Orville Barrant.
Corliss Orville Barrant. Apparently a direct descendant of Mr. Corliss, some very famous steam engine inventor.
He made it efficient.
He made it efficient. And that's what we want to do today, is have an efficient reporting trip. With this patent in hand, Cobb thought he could force the world's largest car makers to pay him royalties on an idea he believed they were clearly using. But there was a problem, a big one. Cobb didn't own the patent. Not only that, the company to which Cobb had assigned ownership, Investment Rarities, Inc. of Minneapolis, had failed to pay the U.S. Patent Office the maintenance fees due on all 12 of the patents Barrant had garnered over the course of a decade. So Cobb's invention slipped into the public domain. Today, anyone can use it for free. By the time I finished telling John the particulars, we had arrived at our destination, Benson's Transmission Center. Wow, there are a lot of trucks around here. I don't see anyone here. It's open here.
Hi.
Hi.
Are you here to see Cobb?
Yes, here to see Cobb. We entered a cramped, wood-paneled office and were greeted by the office manager, who fetched Cobb from the garage.
Harry?
Hey, Cobb. Nice to meet you. Pleased to meet you.
Long time.
How you doing?
John, pleased to meet you.
Well-groomed, dressed in a black leather vest and black jeans, with piercing gray eyes that would occasionally flutter shut as if he were about to fall asleep, Cobb greeted us with a hearty handshake and immediately launched into his story. His dream was to have car engines communicate with satellites that would calibrate the engine to operate at optimum efficiency depending on where you were driving in the U.S. What kind of car is it again?
A 1965 Corvair, or I should say half of a 1965 Corvair. So we cut the engine in half, and we rotated it 90 degrees, and we made a opposed pushrod six-cylinder into an upright three-cylinder overhead cam engine with variable compression, variable cam phasing, and variable valve events that all can be adjusted by radio control, because we were trying to advocate that you could reprogram things on the fly from satellites before there were satellites. So we were hitchhiking and we were going to do it off of a radio station.
As a noisy printer churned out page after page of invoices, we stood there in the office listening to Cobb, trying to get him to focus on the timeline, when he invented what, and how his whole odyssey began.
Yeah. And what year were you? What years were you showing this around?
Early 80s.
Early 80s.
Yep,
and you say we. Who was involved with?
Well, at that time we had so much money. We had several professional people that would transport the car, and I mean, we were dealing with presidents of companies, and it was a high roller venture. I mean, you know, we were eating in these restaurants with Muhammad Ali and all these. You know, it was quite the role. I was there to stay on top of technology. I wasn't there to be worried about hotel rooms, transportation, or anything. The company said, you think variable valve timing from when you get up and you go to bed, and everything else is on us, because that's the only way we were going to get to the top.
Here is a man who believed his invention could change the world for the better. Cheaper, cleaner cars, a better environment, less dependence on foreign oil. The world was his oyster. He was eating in fine restaurants, talking with top executives at big automakers, and he was turning down multi-million dollar offers to develop engines for the likes of GM, all because his venture capitalist, Investment Rarities, thought it could get more. But when its core business, gold trading, went south in the late 1980s, Investment Rarities dropped Cobb and his patents. Cobb recalled the grim day in 1988 when he stood between the local post office and a McDonald's, trying to decide whether to spend the only money he had left on a cheeseburger for his growling stomach or postage for his last remaining patent.
And everybody, I mean everybody, said, walk away from it, give it up. You've wasted your life over it. And I said, no way, this is the control patent. Anybody that ever lands one of these mamas has got easy street for the rest of his life. And that's how the fight. In the end, the financial, it wasn't believable. I couldn't tell you a story you couldn't put it in words how horrible the financial end of the deal was. And I wrote it through, and then basically nothing happened for years. The investment rarities got, basically the IRS shut them down.
Cobb's eyes fluttered again, and it looked as though he might break into tears at any moment. The nostalgia for what he had and what might have been seemed too much. He'd made a huge mistake somewhere along the line, and he knew just what it was.
The dilemma that I got myself in is a dilemma that any engineer in the world can get in. I lost everything I owned. I mean, I lived in that car. I mean, that was my address. That's how far I went down the tube. And there was no money to pay maintenance fees. So the United States government took away all 12 of my patents. Basically, I started having some stress-related health problems. I'm certified crazy. I'm on SSI, totally mentally disabled. I mean, I was declared crazy. It says right on my papers, obsessive compulsive behavior associated with engine patents. It says it right on my papers, right on the deal when they went down and analyzed me.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, I lost everything. I lost my house. I lost all my cars. I lost everything. I was freaking homeless. I lived in that goddamn car for a while. I mean, how many inventors live in their prototypes? I mean, is that ridiculous or what? I mean, it was just, I ruined my family with the deal. I mean, but it was, in terms of what happened to me, basically, I was left to rot for 8 years.
The annals of technology are filled with stories about inventors whose epic struggles over their inventions drove them over the edge. Some, like Edwin Armstrong, inventor of FM radio, take their own lives. Others, like Nikola Tesla, the father of alternating current, suffered, like Cobb, from obsessive-compulsive disorder. Tesla required any repeated actions in his life, such as the footsteps he took in a walk, to be divisible by 3, and he would keep repeating them until he arrived at the right total. When we met with Cobb, it was apparent that his obsessive compulsions focused entirely on car engines. But beyond that, it seemed to me that some essential part of him, what some people might call a soul, I guess, was indistinguishable from his invention. He is the variable valve mechanism, and it is him. When, after over an hour of conversation, I asked to see the prototype, his sleepy, medicated eyes sparkled to life, and like a kid on Christmas morning, he bounded through the door leading to the garage and showed us the modified Corvair.
Okay, now this is in the economy mode, and you can listen. When we go into the performance mode, you will see the idle quality deteriorate. Well, just to simulate that, I'll show you what happens here if I push it all the way up.
I'm out of gas. I'm broke down again. Almost home.
Maintenance fees are a capitalist tool for driving small people out of business, and the small guy, in my opinion, is always the guy that gets us 5 years ahead. I mean, that's what the patent deal does, is that the sooner we get something birthed and into the incubation period, the greater the potential to capitalize on, you know, on the large-scale employment we can derive from it. Mm-hmm. So we need the guys birthing, and we need to keep them alive. Well, how the hell are you going to do that, and how could a state do that and make and get a return on their money. And I think making the payment of maintenance fees and possibly the patent application cost eligible for tax credits, probably another thing I would say on that is I think especially things that have to do with environment and energy, you know, they have a social value as well as not just another hula hoop, but things that have a social value also.
All right. Well, I think we need to be getting on.
Okay.
As we drove back to Minneapolis, John and I talked about how it was appropriate somehow that we hadn't met Cobb anywhere but the garage. The garage was where Cobb really lived, even when his body was sleeping somewhere else. He tries to solve the same problem over and over again, how to get control of his patents back. And that's as far as he'll go, because what lies beyond patent battles with some of the world's largest corporations is too remote a possibility even for Cobb to contemplate, and surely too expensive for him to ever afford. His patents expire next year, and hope with them. And hope is the only thing that's kept Cobb's motor running all these years. As the frozen expanse of Great White North suburbia flashed by, the trailer parks cheek by jowl with the giant malls filled with last-minute shoppers, part of me wished I'd asked Cobb how he was going to spend Christmas. Another part of me couldn't bear to know. For Living on Earth, I'm Harry Goldstein.
Harry Goldstein is a reporter for Spectrum Radio, the broadcast edition of IEEE Spectrum Magazine. To see photos of Corliss Orville Barrant, a.k.a. Cobb, and his invention, visit our website, livingonearth.org. Next week on Living on Earth, a little storytelling, a little comfort food, and a whole lot of blues.
We make a good gumbo. Oh, yes, we do. We make a good gumbo on the old bayou. Oh, yeah.
Gumbo is, you know, it's very simple. A lot of people think gumbo is we go in there and empty out the leftovers in the refrigerator and put it all in one pot, and that's gumbo. No, that's not the case.
That's Cajun blues guitarist Tab Benoit. He joins me next week for Living on Earth's Christmastime holiday special, Longing for Louisiana. Tab and others will brew a mix of holiday spirits, including a Cajun version of The Night Before Christmas.
"'Twas the night before Christmas, and all through the house, they don't a tink pass, not even a mouse. The children been nestled, good snug on the floor, and Mom passed the pepper through the crack in the door. Then Mama in the fireplace done rolls up the ham, stir up the gumbo, and bake the yam."
Storyteller Angela Davis will spin a tale of New Orleans Christmas past.
"I hear you a storyteller. You know any ghost stories? Why don't we pass the time telling ghost stories?"
And Dr. Jazz, the trumpet-playing coroner of New Orleans, talks about his love of the city's music and how much his absence is affecting him this time of year.
"My mother played a lot of gospel stuff. But around Christmas holidays, there was always music every day. Either my mother or my grandmother was playing."
Chef Susan Spicer also joins the Couchon de Lait to talk about reopening her New Orleans restaurant, Bayona, and the Louisiana standard she's cooking for Christmas, and it ain't no turkey.
"Something that always says holiday time in New Orleans to me is oysters."
As for Tab Benoit, he's sticking to his gumbo.
"The thing is with the roux, you have to constantly stir it. And it's going to take you a good 40, 45 minutes of stirring, constant stirring. And you can't stop. So once you start that roux, you know, you better get you something to drink right next to there and get all of your trinity, which is the bell peppers, onions, and celery. That's what we call the trinity. And you constantly stir it, and it doesn't do anything for a long time, but then all of a sudden it starts browning and it starts getting that good kind of popcorn smell to it, and whew, man, I'm getting hungry." "Is this a cooking show?"
Yes, it's a cooking show and more on our Christmastime holiday special, Longing for Louisiana, next week on Living on Earth. Ça c'est bon.
"We make a good gumbo with a loving touch from New Orleans. way down to the gut. Oh, yeah.
We leave you this week with the voice of the Louisiana Bayou. Kim Wilson recorded this chorus of bird songs, frog calls, alligator grunts, and the squeal of an amphibian being skewered by a heron in the primordial waters of the bayou. Living on Earth is produced by the World Media Foundation. Our crew includes Ashley Ahern, Chris Ballman, Eileen Belinsky, Ingrid Lobet, and Susan Shepherd, with help from Christopher Bollett, Kelly Cronin, James Kerwood, and Michelle Queter. Our interns are Brianna Asbury, Kevin Friedel, and Emily Torgrimson. Our technical director is Dennis Foley. Allison Dean composed our themes. You can find us at loe.org. I'm Steve Kerwood. Thanks for listening.
Funding for Living on Earth comes from the National Science Foundation, supporting coverage of emerging science, and Stonyfield Farm, organic yogurt, smoothies, and milk. 10% of profits are donated to efforts that help protect and restore the Earth. Details at stonyfield.com. Support also comes from NPR member stations, the Ford Foundation, the Oak Foundation, and the Saunders Hotel Group of Boston's Lenox and Copley Square Hotels, serving you and the environment while helping preserve the past and protect the future. 800-225-7676.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.